The following is an excerpt from the Science Podcast. To hear the whole show, visit www.sciencemag.org and click on Science Podcast.
Finally today, we have David Grimm, online news editor of Science. He's here to give us a rundown of some of the recent stories from our daily news site. Okay, Dave, so first up, we have a story about what big brains get you.
Right. Well, creatures with big brains are somewhat considered more intelligent by scientists, or at least more cognitively complex. But all this has sort of been a correlation. And what these researchers did, this is a group of researchers from Sweden, was they looked at guppies. And what they basically did was they bred them to have smaller or larger brains. They were actually able to achieve about a 10% disparity in brain size. So some fish that had relatively large brains for guppies and some guppies that had relatively small brains. And then they taught the fish to count.
Okay. So obviously the big brain ones were good at counting.
Right. And the big brain ones were better at counting. The researchers basically showed them cards that had either two or four symbols on it, and the symbols were associated with food. And the large brain fish seemed to get it, suggesting that they had a rudimentary counting ability where the smaller brain fish didn't have that. So this is the first evidence researchers had that actually, yes, making brains bigger actually seems to make a creature smarter.
Wow. So what does that mean for all the other animals out there?
Well, it could mean that big brains do indeed make us smart. But the researchers also saw that big brains tend to come with a cost. These fish that had bigger brains tended to give birth to less offspring. They also tended to have smaller guts, which is a correlation that's been seen in humans and other animals with large brains as well. And the thinking is that perhaps, you know, these big brains are really energetically costly. They take a lot of sort of energy from the body. And if you're going to spend that much energy on one organ, you're going to have to devote less energy to other organs, maybe even the reproductive organs, maybe the gut. Another hypothesis with the gut is that if we have bigger brains and we're smarter, we may be able to be a bit more choosy about our food choices. We may be able to eat smarter foods, and we don't need these large guts to sort out all the different, maybe sort of non-selective foods that creatures with not as big brains are selecting for. This is all sort of in the realm of mystery right now. But the important thing the study is really showing is that this is no longer just a correlation. By actually changing brain size, researchers are actually able to show a causative effect between the size of the brain and some of these other factors.
Well, I can't wait to see what they do in other animals. Next up, we have a study on body language in squirrels.
And this study comes with a very cool video, which I encourage everybody to check out on the site. It's a video of a California ground squirrel approaching its burrow, which is this hole in the ground. And he gets really close to the burrow, and out pops a snake. And the squirrel does this really unusual thing where the squirrel starts really shaking its tail really hard back and forth. Almost if you've got a cat and you've sort of seen your cat sort of get agitated at something, the tail sort of whips back and forth. That's sort of what this squirrel is doing. And researchers sort of thought the squirrels were doing this maybe to scare off snakes. They weren't really sure. Another unusual thing researchers have observed is that other squirrels in the vicinity, when they would see another squirrel shake its tail, would also start shaking its tail too, even though they didn't see the snake, and there was sort of a mystery about why they were doing that.
So how do the researchers study this? I mean, they have a video. Were they filming a lot of squirrel activities?
what they did was they trekked out into the California wilderness, and they grabbed a bunch of snakes, anesthetized them, and inserted tracking devices in them. And then they followed them around with these modified security cameras. They had the tracking devices, so they sort of knew where the snakes were going to go. So they still had to sift through hours and hours of footage to find videos like the one on the site. But one of the first things they noticed is what you see in the video, that the squirrels actually do seem to be thrashing their tails in response to the snakes. Not only that, but it does seem to scare the snakes off. These can be very deadly for squirrels. There's actually part of the video where a snake actually jumps out of the hole and does bite a squirrel. And what the snakes do is they bite the squirrel, then let go, and the squirrel wanders off and dies.
Oh.
And then the snake goes and eats it. What happened with one of these squirrels, because the squirrel started swishing its tail, the snake kind of freaks out and goes back into its hole. So that was sort of the first thing that the researchers discovered, was that, yes, this shaking behavior actually does seem to have a positive effect for the squirrels. But what was even more interesting that they noticed was that squirrels in the vicinity were shaking their tails like I said earlier, even when they didn't see the snake, and
right.
there was sort of a mystery about why that was happening. One idea was that squirrels just do this at random, that there's really not a whole lot of thinking. It's what researchers call kind of like an artificial signal. They're not really clued into any sort of alarm call. They're just sort of shaking their tails. But that's not what the researchers saw. They saw that they were really shaking their tails in response to seeing that initial squirrel shaking its tail when it saw the snake, which suggests that this shaking the tail is not only a way for a squirrel to avoid being bitten, it's what researchers call an honest signal. It's a warning signal that other squirrels pick up on, and they say, oh, wow, you know, my buddy is shaking his tail. He must see a snake. I'm going to start shaking my tail. And what the researcher saw is when a snake sees a bunch of other squirrels shaking their tails as well, he sort of hightails it out of the area. So it's a very effective strategy, not only for the squirrel itself, but for the entire population.
So this is kind of a novel study because they got a really up close look at predator prey behavior.
Right. This is really hard stuff to study. And if you do try to study it, you ended up just hoping you get lucky. And what's kind of cool about the study is these researchers were a lot more proactive. They actually caught the snakes, tagged them, and were able to sort of follow them around. I mean, they still had to do a lot of work to catch these sort of interactions in the act. But researchers say, you know, this is sort of a good methodology going forward to sort of observing other predator-prey relationships in the wild.
Yeah, I hope they make an internet squirrel cam for us. Okay, David, last up we have a story on inbreeding depression in plants.
Right. Inbreeding depression is, if you've ever heard the rule, you know, you shouldn't marry your cousin or shouldn't have relations with close relatives. The reason is because people who are very closely related who tend to get together tend to have offspring that have a lot of problems, mental illness, infertility, really rare genetic diseases cropping up. And the reason is because if you have two people that are very highly related that mate, they tend to harbor the same very rare genes. And so all of a sudden you've got genes that are very rare becoming much more prominent because they sort of combine in two people and they get expressed in the offspring. And that's what inbreeding depression is. And pretty much forever, as long as scientists have really been studying this, they've really just chalked it up to these rare genetic mutations. Mm-hmm. But this new study in plants suggests that there may be something else going on as well.
So how do they observe inbreeding depression in plants?
Well, they looked at a plant called the Scabiosa columbaria plant. And this is a plant that is native to Europe and Asia. It has dark green leaves topped with small, delicate purple flowers. You can see a picture of it on the site. They're actually very pretty plants. And what's interesting about these plants is these plants also suffer from inbreeding depression. When the researchers mated very closely related plants together, they tended to be a lot more susceptible to drought and poor soil. They tended to be killed a lot more easily by these environmental conditions than plants that were not inbred. And at first, the researchers said, well, you know, it's probably the same thing that happens in people. These plants probably have these pretty rare genes. And when we breed close relatives, these rare bad genes or bad mutations are sort of coming to the fore and causing the offspring to be a lot more sickly than they would be otherwise.
So they thought the same thing was going on, but they found out that it was actually not just special deleterious genes.
Right, exactly. And the reason they began to suspect that is because it's known that environmental conditions like drought and poor nutrition can cause what are called epigenetic changes. And these are changes not in the genes themselves, when we think of sort of as a standard typical mutation, but actually chemical groups that get added or subtracted from DNA, and it can actually cause genes to be turned on or turned off. And lo and behold, when the researchers looked at these plants that were really highly inbred, they noticed that they had a lot more of these chemical groups, they're actually called methyl groups, on their genomes than plants that were not inbred. So they were all of a sudden seeing this correlation between these epigenetic changes and problems that are associated with inbreeding.
So a lot more genes were covered in these markings. What does that mean for the plant?
Well, what it means is that the plant probably has a lot more genes being turned on and off than other plants are. And somehow, and the research still don't know how, but turning the genes on and off may be sort of contributing to some of the problems with inbreeding. And in fact, when the researchers treated the plants with a chemical that removes these methyl groups, the plants actually did a lot better. So there really does seem to be a pretty significant effect
Wow.
of these epigenetic changes in causing these problems that are associated with inbreeding.
So they could rescue these plants from the effects of inbreeding?
They could, yes.
So, okay, let's take it the next step. What can this do for the royalty?
Well, that's a great question. First of all, they haven't even shown that this would actually even work in the wild. I mean, there's a lot of problems right now. Conservation biologists are really concerned about a lot of plants being impacted by climate change, by human encroachment. It's causing potentially a lot more inbreeding than would happen otherwise, mm-hmm. which is causing these plants to be a lot more susceptible. So one idea is, well, let's just treat them with this chemical and maybe we can reverse the effects of inbreeding. That really hasn't been done yet, but it's an idea. If that worked, I mean, it's still a pretty big chasm between plants and people.
Right.
So there's no guarantee that, first of all, even if these epigenetic changes are actually happening in people as well, mm-hmm. and if they are, whether we could just sort of give people a drug and that would reverse these changes. But it's really an intriguing first step towards something like that.
Definitely. What else is on the site this week, David?
Well, Sarah, we've got a story about cornstarch and water. And if you mix them together and walk over them, you don't sink like you should. You're able to form a solid. This has been a very mysterious phenomenon that's puzzled physicists for a long time. And now researchers say they have a new explanation for what's really going on there. Also, a story about a gene that may confer some protection against Alzheimer's disease. We've got a story about some global policy efforts to save coral. Also a story about how a new transport law in the U.S. may be having a negative impact on archaeology studies here. And finally, for Science Live, our weekly chat on the hottest topics in science, this week's Science Live is about life after the Higgs boson. Now that we've discovered the Higgs boson, what's next for particle physics? And next week's Science Live is about sports-related head injuries. What is neuroscience telling us about what happens to people when they get hit pretty hard when they're playing sports? So be sure to check out all these stories on the site.
Thanks, David. David Grimm is the online news editor for Science. You can check out the latest news and the policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org, where you can also join a live chat, Science Live, on the hottest science topics every Thursday at 3 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time.